This is Murder in the Morning with Tony Bruschi and Stacey Cole.
Today we are pulling back the curtain on the unsettling psychology behind some of the most infamous relationships in true crime, and maybe even ourselves. We'll do a little digging and dive deep into those subtle yet terrifying red flags. Had someone noticed? Could have changed everything, maybe. We're not just talking about obvious abuse here. We're peeling back the layers on those quietly sinister behaviors, the kind you brush off until you're suddenly at the center of a Dateline special. Licensed marriage and family therapist Sonnet Daymont is here to talk us through how emotional abuse quietly takes root, escalates, and how to spot it long before tragedy makes the headlines. Sonnet, there's so many cases to talk about, cases like Lori Vallow Daybell, or many. When it starts one way and ends in a completely different area, is there a hidden psychological architecture, something systematic, maybe predictable, that fuels an abuser's journey from charm to violence?
There are certain red flags that you can pull up that happen rather regularly with narcissistic abuse or dark triad relationships that tend to be a little different than when someone's just emotionally immature and you're having a hard time and a lot of conflicts.
And that's a big thing, because the word narcissist gets thrown out a lot, and there's obviously a huge difference between we all have narcissistic traits to narcissistic personality disorder and the dark triad and cluster B personalities and all that fun stuff. Where is that line? I mean, obviously someone needs to go in and be diagnosed if you're going to, you know, officially get the fun title of narcissistic personality disorder. But if you're in a relationship with someone, where are areas, I mean, that maybe can be looked at that may make you go, this is more than just, you know, someone having a bad day. This is more than just someone that's, you know, kind of narcissistic, somewhat selfish, but they give and take a bit. How does one identify some of this stuff early on, and are there ways, honestly?
So as a psychotherapist, I treat abuse survivors here in the office. And typically what I look for when people come in and they want to talk about their relationships and they're trying to determine, you know, is this emotionally immature or am I in something that's like setting up to be abusive? One of the things I watch for as a therapist is what the level of emotional abuse looks like. There's diagnostic measures. The Gottmans have created their own measure for emotional abuse, and we'll look at that together. One of the things that I tend to see more often when you're dating someone who's going to be like really disturbed, and it's going to turn into a very difficult, challenging, abusive situation, like some of these true crimes that that you all are talking about on the show, is how they resolve conflicts and if the kindness is consistent. Yeah. And so when you're in a relationship with someone who's emotionally immature, they might be reactive sometimes because they haven't learned to regulate themselves, but they can experience empathy and apologize for it. And usually they can consciously change their behavior. If you're in a relationship with someone who is more on that dark triad spectrum or going to build up to be more abusive than you might have the capacity to work through as a couple, you're going to see inconsistent kindness, and you're going to see a progression of abusive behavior that gets worse and worse in time. And when you work on the conflicts together, they may or may not apologize, but they won't be able to do that work to show that they're trying to grow. You won't see a progression of intimacy or working through conflict. Conflict's a form of intimacy. It's very healthy. We need conflict in order to sort of negotiate and navigate where we want to be. But it needs to like evolve and grow and become healthier and healthier as you go along in the relationship, not deteriorate.
Sure.
Name calling, isolation, those sorts of devaluing behaviors you're probably familiar with. Watch out.
And with conflict resolution, I mean, I think a lot of times people end up in these sort of relationships because there isn't a lot of conflict, at least at the front end. And that can go on for long periods of time. I know that's part of love bombing, but it can just go on. And then suddenly you may not even realize you're having conflicts, but it can be kind of insidious. Is that where we see a lot of these things kind of turn for the worst in relationships, where suddenly, you know, you just don't realize that you're the frog in the pot that's boiling, and suddenly your significant other is, you know, burying your children in the backyard, and you're justifying it with some sort of bizarre offset of Mormon religion?
Yeah. So it sounds like you're talking about like love bombing.
Yeah.
Right. I heard you use that word. And so that tends to refer to early stages of a relationship with someone who is going to end up being like a dark triad or abusive in some kind of personality disorder oriented way. And that can look like really intense interaction and compliments and gift giving and trips. And you're just sort of bombarded, right, with so much love and affection that it's hard for you to see straight. And it is often manipulative, I suppose, in a relationship like that. There's like a consciousness with the person who's engaged with it that they're not being their whole natural self. They're feeling frustrated, but they're not expressing it. In time, it kind of breaks down and you start having bouts of like inconsistent kindness. And then that's the point where you kind of want to check in with yourself and say, like, is this an emotionally immature relationship? Do we need some help figuring out communication? Or is this person's like kind of sadistic and manipulative? Mm-hmm. And if you're having a lot of conflicts and you're figuring out that the person you're in conflict with experiences empathy, they're curious and they can hear that you're hurt and they don't want you to be hurt. Mm-hmm. And then the two of you can figure out how to navigate not hurting each other and their success in that. Mm-hmm. And you get through these conflicts in a well-resolved way. Then they're less likely to be abusive. If you're dealing with someone who's inconsistently kind, and the sadisticness like amps up and amps up and amps up, and 6 months in, everything's great. You're living off that early dating brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. And then the relationship starts to get more, routine, devaluing comments come in, belittling comes in. And
it's not always in the form of arguments. It's in those form of those little tiny things until something, I think in a lot of ways, that seems to be how it goes. Stacey, I know you had a question.
Yeah, Damon, I'm curious about, you know, let's turn the lens around just a little bit. What about, and I don't want to victim blame in any way, but what about the people who are attracted to this kind of person? I think a lot of people have that person in their lives that they have a type, and you're like, oh, girl, you know, you just dated a guy like this. And they keep gravitating toward this person who is just popping red flags like it's ice fishing season. You know, the flag is just popping all over the place. And it's like, it's you go from one relationship season to the next.
It's like 10 people who
Midwest reference in there. Sorry. If you've never ice fished before, the flag pops up. But
like, what?
Sorry.
No. So I mean, what you're saying makes a lot of sense, right? I, especially as women, you gave the example of as a girlfriend or a woman going through it. But men,
I mean, even Billie Eilish wrote a song, "Bad Guy." I mean, it's just it's so prevalent in our society that it's this guy who raises every red flag. He's so attractive. He's the bad boy. He's this. He's that.
But
and then you know, Mr. Nice Guy sitting over here. Well, he's our friend that we'll go to everything falls to shit.
I would say half the time the people we talk about are not the bad boys. They're the ones that look like the nice guy. They're the ones that are sitting there that you can get that it's sucked in by. I would say a lot of the bad guys, that's on you. Like if you're going for all the red flags, there's no psychological manipulation going on there. I guess it's more like, what is going on? Why are you attracted to that? Is like, or why not you, but why are some people attracted to that sort of thing? Is that the angle?
Yes. Okay. That's because I know so many people that is what they go for. They see the guy who was raising the flags and they're like, I want that.
Yeah.
I want that in my life. You know, and we're left to pick up the pieces as friends and support systems. Like, we saw this coming from a mile away. We saw these flags. Why aren't you seeing them? And again, we don't want to victim blame, but what is it about these charismatic personalities? What, Tony?
I'll victim blame on that one because I was always the nice guy off in the corner while y'all are like, ah.
So let's talk about that a little bit because it's a good observation. You both have had it, and I've had it myself. And I think anyone who's watching your show or just out socializing in the world has met people where they get out of one relationship that looks really hard, abusive, challenging, and then before you know it, they're in another one.
Yeah.
It's a lot of people, men and women included, where they get out of one relationship like that and they're so relieved. That's never going to happen again. And then they wake up and like those sort of red flags or small behaviors start coming in and they're like, no, this can't be happening again. It's easy to picture them like being in denial and just not wanting to believe it's true. And it is really hard to look at the self and say, wait a minute, am I attracted to something unhealthy? What's happening here? And, you know, after a challenging relationship, an abusive relationship or a toxic relationship or just really in general, I tend to think we should take a big break where we look at ourselves, feel through the sadness, feel through the emotions, get sort of our financial, emotional, physical safety and homeostasis back in line, learn about healthy relationships before we start going out there and dating again. And when you have a friend or a loved one who you see cycling through abusive relationships, a good way to handle that as a support system is to say, you know, it looks like there's been a couple. And if you go into therapy or you want to look at some workbooks on healthy relationships and healing after these relationships, there's a lot of information available to heal with. As a therapist here in this practice, what I tend to start with is a book by Susan Elliott called Getting Past Your Breakup. And in chapter 6 of that book, she has a little lineup of about 13 journaling questions that you can answer about the relationship you were just in. And what I tend to do, I'm so visual, give me one second.
Sure.
Is I tend to have clients come in and, you know, they've got those 13 questions. And I'll say, why don't you just go ahead and put a couple lines on a piece of paper and let's do three X's. And just because the last one was abusive, let's do two others before them. Mm-hmm. And then we've got data points on what feels good in relationships, what doesn't feel good, and what sort of the timeline of the difficult behaviors becoming like conscious of you to you is, right? And you've got these three people. And then the next section of chapter 6 of that book, Getting Past Your Breakup by Susan Elliott, she has you do similar questions on people who helped raise you. So if you were raised by two parents, a grandparent, a sibling, you went to boarding school, who was really present when you were raised? And you do those same questions on them. Mm-hmm. And then you've got like maybe 6, 5, I don't know how many rows you would have between caregivers and people you've dated. You've got all these data points on these are behaviors I put up with, but I don't like. It's really clear and conscious. Mm-hmm. And the idea with like trauma reenactments or I'm a cognitive behavior therapist. I do CBT, EMDR, positive psychology, and a little bit of feminist theory. And to the point of religion, if we end up talking about any of these religious traumas, I studied existential therapy too. So that's very interesting to me. And I've got some info there that maybe could be helpful. But point being, you can look at the relationships with parents, even from a CBT perspective, cognitive behavior therapy, or more of a tool-based therapy, psychodynamic therapy. You look at your relationship with your parents and how that influences who you date and who you relate to and how you relate to people, right? But this spreadsheet system, this like data grabbing system, really lets people look at those relationships with the parents. And if parents were, I don't know, calling you a name, like you had a crappy nickname as a kid, and you go on a date with someone and they nag you a little bit and start putting you down, you might not even notice that you're experiencing red flags. Like, sure, 6 months in, but maybe some other girl who grew up with a more supportive, loving family, she would have gone on date one and been like, wait, they made fun of what I'm eating? I'm out of here.
It's because it's so normalized, especially when it comes from a family member. And sometimes you don't even realize like the trauma that one may have had until you're out of that environment. And you're like, oh, wait a second, that really wasn't very healthy. And then you end up surrounding yourself with people who end up being similar to that, because even though it may be unhealthy, it feels safe. It feels more at home, I think, for a lot of us. And until you realize that and break out of that, that's a very hard cycle to get out of. Trauma bonding seems to be a big thing with a lot of the cases we cover here. We got one person with that person, and it's usually around something, whether it be religion, like Lori and Chad Daybell. I mean, their mm-hmm. trauma is talking about the end of the world and how this is all going to go to hell and what are we going to do? And then sometimes you just have, you know, kind of the broken people thing. You got one that's had some troubles, maybe they've gotten better and life has changed, and the other had a rough time. And then and you're trauma bonding, you're forming that relationship, not based on necessarily who that person authentically is, but it's around events in one's life. That's got to be an important thing early on when someone is getting into a relationship. And this is more so from the angle of look at the red flags you may not realize are red flags. Would that be looking at why are you interested in this person? What is bonding you to this person? Is it all because you both had all these tragedies in your life and you can just commiserate back and forth and play one up who had the worst childhood? Versus what are you genuinely interested? You know, what are your passions? What makes you excited? What makes you happy? That seems to be, it's easier to go down the one road because it is kind of dark and people like talking about themselves. And the other is more, it takes a little more digging, takes a little more introspection sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to your point, this idea of the trauma bond. So it sounds like the way you're defining it is that two people have trauma in common.
Yes.
And then sort of where they bond in the relationship.
Not necessarily that they had a trauma together, like they both were in a train accident and they survived.
The relationship itself is so traumatized.
Exactly. It's a trauma bond in that form of way.
So what I was kind of hearing you say is sort of like this pan back awareness of what is a healthy relationship mm-hmm. and what are healthy things to relate based on.
Yeah, because while it may feel comfortable to talk about a lot of those things, and you can really feel a connection with someone that way, but what are some of the red flags where, initially you can kind of bond over this or that, but what are you really bonding over? It's like, you have friends and all you do with those people is just, complain about somebody. It's like, that's not healthy.
So it sounds like what you're speaking to is like when you go out and you try to date, are you consciously paying attention to what's a healthy way to relate and what are healthy points to relate on? Mm-hmm. And my thought on that would be if you're a person kind of catching that and wondering like, hey, wait, I've had a couple of these unhealthy relationships or clearly something's up with my the parent of my children because mm-hmm. navigating custody is so hard or whatever sort of like the indicators are that you need to do some work on how you pick people. That can be done in therapy, obviously, but there's a lot of great resources and research out there in the world. I made reference to the Gottman assessment for emotional abuse earlier. The Gottmans are a couple of researchers that are literally a couple. And they researched what methods work in keeping relationships together long term mm-hmm. and what are healthy ways to relate to people. And then they found skills that exist in healthy relationships, and then they taught them to other couples and were able to prove that if you teach these skills, relationships are likely to last longer. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of how do I choose who's a good partner for me, research on that exists. What is a good book? There's a book called How to Not Die Alone by Logan Urey. And my understanding is she was a researcher at Google, and her job was to try to make the app more addictive by working on like the user experience, user interface. And then she moved over to Hinge, mm-hmm. which is one of those dating apps. And in this book, she's sort of selling her dating coach business mm-hmm. as opposed to like her technology helper role. Mm-hmm. And in the book, she brings in all this research that she used to make those apps more addictive, but she also brings in a lot of research on what is a healthy relationship. And when you're looking for a healthy relationship, what do you look for? Mm-hmm. And she's got little worksheets and explanations for how you figure that out for yourself. one of the things that I think is really great in that book, if you're a reader and you come across this podcast, is on page 169, she's got these top 8 questions. And these are 8 questions you're supposed to ask yourself after you go on a date with someone. And they say things like, did you feel attractive in their presence? Right. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, are they attractive to you? But like, how do you feel when you're with them?
Yeah.
Did you laugh together? Right. Mm-hmm. And if you get together with someone and you're both talking about how terrifying the news is and what's in your prepper kit, you're probably not laughing and mm-hmm. you're probably not like feeling embodied and attractive and free. Right. Like those are the things that tend to keep relationships together long term. Now, that said, relationships shift in time. There's neuroscience to early dating and what it feels like early on in a relationship, intimacy, talking, all of those things, mm-hmm. and what they feel like later in a relationship too,
mm-hmm.
that she gets into in that book. It's a great read for anyone who, I guess, doesn't want to die alone. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Funny name.
I wonder, I mean, sometimes breaking down people, not breaking them down, but understanding their makeup, it feels like once you kind of understand what makes different types of people tick, different personality types tick, different people with different personality disorders tick, it kind of becomes a guide. It kind of becomes like, oh, I understand this language now. And before that, things can kind of just look chaotic. Why would the person do this or that? Why would they react this way to this situation? Now they're acting this way to that one. I feel, as studying a lot of this, once I learned more about different type of personality disorders and narcissism and all of that, a lot more made a lot more sense. It wasn't so out of the blue when this person's going to do this or that, because you're coming from your perspective of how you would react to something. And I think a lot of people never kind of get off that push and that ramp of, well, why do I keep falling into the river when I go off this ramp? Well, because the river's there. Learn how the river flows, learn how that river works, and maybe you need a bigger ramp. But is there something to be said about the public just getting more educated on different personality types and what to expect and what to look out for, rather than after the crash landing? I feel having that knowledge myself, having gone through some pretty toxic relationships with a borderline and a narcissist, I have an incredible outlook when I meet people now and what to look out for. I wish I would have known many of these things prior to being in those sort of relationships, but those sort of things aren't taught in schools. I mean, unless you're going for psychology. But it seems like these could be such valuable tools of human interaction mm-hmm. that we just gloss over as if they're not important at all.
Yeah, so it sounds like what you're saying is, after you have a relationship with someone who is on that personality disorder spectrum, be it a borderline mm-hmm. or a narcissist or sociopath, antisocial,
yeah,
even, you know, there's lots of personality disorders out there. The ways in which you learn to like watch for those personality types and what their drives are become amplified, and you're able to sort of see it better and get away from it if it's something that you're not interested in being involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And it also sounded like you said that having more of like a public discourse about it, like people talking about narcissists and what their drives are, people talking about sociopaths.
Just understanding it as another language, basically. I mean, once you understand another language, you can communicate with it, or you can understand where it's going to go. I feel like some of these traits are very much just like, it's like learning another language, but no one teaches you. It's usually we end up learning about it after we've, you know, been bombarded by this language that we didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the benefit of getting through a relationship like that, is that you do learn to read people better and you get leadership skills, because mm-hmm. if you're hiring a team to work with, you're going to be kind of watching for what people's motivations or drives are when you mm-hmm. interview them, see how they would work in a team, right? Can they share space? Do they need to be the center of attention? Do they need all the power? Are they afraid they're going to be abandoned so much so that you can't even get anything done because you're mm-hmm. constantly like,
yeah. Yeah. And recognizing when those traits are toxic and not just, oh, they're kind of needy, because people will put, you know, false labels on things. But when it's a pattern, that's when people need to, you know, wake up a little bit more, I think. Stacey, go ahead.
Well, is there a way to differentiate between, you know, we had a great marriage, things were great, we were best of friends, we start to grow apart, and now you're starting to see abusive behavior. How do you know the difference between things are just falling apart and not working anymore to, wow, this person, for whatever reason, is now evolving into somebody who is abusive and narcissistic? I mean, do people evolve into these patterns, or have they been there this whole time and are just now being noticed? Is there a way to differentiate between that?
I mean, I think it's you need a lot of detail about the relationship. But if you're in a relationship with someone and they're not experiencing empathy ever, activated or not, you know, upset or not, that's a important thing to pay attention to, because you need to be with someone who's empathetic, who can be curious and feel into what you're experiencing in order to create a quality of collaborative life together. Just, you know, and if you are with someone and they one day just suddenly don't care what you feel about anything, and they aren't able to sort of be curious enough to work through any conflicts to where they make sure that you feel cared for, tended for, your needs are met, why would you want to be in that situation?
Yeah. You know,
if you're going back and forth and you're trying to chase back into the way they behaved in the early stages, if say there was love bombing or things were good and they've evolved, a good sort of question to ask yourself is like, how's this working for me now? How's this relationship working for me right now? If we're having conflicts, is this person willing to work through them? Do we need to take a little break till they are?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think some of that too, Stace, you're talking about it. It's not so much noticed as it is accepted, in my opinion, of that, where it's sure. Like you notice it, but do you accept it? And are you willing to accept it? Because if you notice it and you accept it, accepting it means you're going to have to, you know, take a big drink of something you may not want to take a drink of and go, okay. Because if this is true over here, that means all these feelings I have over here, you know, they're there, but they're not based on any sort of solid ground. And then you start asking yourself, well, you know, why should I be in it? And then you start going, well, why have I been in it for so long? And then I think you get to shame and guilt, and then those sort of rabbit holes make you stay in it, because it's easier to just go, I haven't accepted it. I kind of noticed it, but it was just kind of a red flag, even though it's glaring. We have a great way, I think, of not noticing some of those things around us until it's, you know, there's no other way out of it.
We can also get kind of puppy trained into staying too.
Mm-hmm.
If someone is really loving and kind early, and then when things start devaluing and falling apart, they're telling you it's your fault. Mm-hmm. And you think, well, maybe I do have control to change it. It is easier to think everything's my fault.
Mm-hmm.
If I just behave the way they want and I do all the work to fix this, we'll be back to where it was before. And it's really easy to get puppy trained to think everything's your fault and like chase after mm-hmm. those good times. Another factor that often leads into this dynamic where you're like stuck in there and you're trying to make sense of what's happening is like feeling trapped, like financially trapped in the situation,
mm-hmm.
Socially isolated to where you don't have any other people. It's really easy to fall in and think that it's you and not the person you're with, or that you can't leave.
Yeah. And a lot of times, especially like narcissists and that will put you in those sort of situations. And it's suddenly you don't realize just how trapped you are, and then trying to dig out can be one hell of a journey. You need a lot of shovels and big ones too. I think we'll wrap up right there. Very, very fascinating conversation. Thank you so much, Sonnet, for being with us and providing the insight that you did today. Very, very much appreciated.
Yeah.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.